that you may understand and apply and know how to speak to others about it. I hope that's the case after we're done, and I appreciate those petitions to God and our joining together to think about faith in these songs before we look at Abraham. I'm going to talk about the faith of Abraham. And I thought about a different title because in some ways the faith of Abraham is a journey, and I think that's true with all of us. If you look early in his life, he had some trials and so on, but you know, and Andrew's talk at the table last Sunday morning, I think it was, you know, looked at that one crucial event of the sacrifice of Isaac. Almost seems like it doesn't even belong in the Bible. It's so strange. It's something, I mean, in a larger context that the pagans of the time might have done in some way, sacrificing their children, thinking that's what the deities wanted. And God asked Abraham to do that. And Andrew gets emotional, and all of us ought to, I think, thinking about the sacrifice of our own child, and yet his willingness to do that. And so how did he get there? This is the outline of the lesson, and it probably will look frightening here because I'm going to review the entire life of Abraham. I don't know how well I'll do on my time budget, but I'm hoping to sweep through the major events and in a way to show that that journey to Mount Moriah was a journey. And it took years. And it didn't just take time, it took events. It took testing of various forms for Abraham to get there. And it took evidence that God could present along the way that he was powerful, that he asked things that were right, that he had a plan that was often surprising to us. These are things that Abraham had to learn along the way so that it may be, not to minimize Abraham's obedience at that point in chapter 22, but it may be that God had prepared him in such a way that it was not really a hard decision for him, that he didn't wrestle with it. He went to bed that night and he got up the next morning early and started out to obey God. You see what I'm getting at? So the title of my lesson changed from the faith of Abraham to the journey of Abraham, and that's the explanation for it. And I hope I can get there with the things we have to say. I'll talk a little bit about the importance of Abraham. The reason I want to put that in there is because I think we need to be like him. If there is a message in the Bible about a character, it's got to be that message about Abraham. As you notice in our service, it seemed like there's been another reference or two to Abraham in the Wednesday night service we had and others. I can't remember. I just remember thinking, yeah, there's Abraham again, getting ready for this lesson. He is referred to quite often. He is the father of the three major religions in the world, Judaism, Christianity, and even Islam, of course, not through Isaac, but through Ishmael. His name is listed, if you count Abram as part of this story, almost 300 times in the Bible. And the amazing thing is, it's listed 73 times in the New Testament, in 11 different books of the New Testament. I'm not sure what statistics are worth, but that's pretty amazing that Abraham the character shows up in Gospels, in Epistles, and other parts of the New Testament, making significant points, not just like, yeah, we're children of Abraham, or the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but I mean making key doctrinal points, which I'll look at in just a minute. In the book of Genesis, it takes up from the latter part of chapter 11. If you remember, Genesis is divided up into what are kind of called genealogies, or these are the generations of, and they're those signposts along the way. And there at the end of chapter 11, that's begins the genealogy of Terah and Abram. And then, of course, in chapter 25, the genealogy of Ishmael, and shortly after that, Isaac. But in the middle of that, what would that be, 10 chapters, 12 or so, is the genealogy of Abraham, the story of Abraham's life that takes up a good bit of that. Remember that Genesis, and I think I say this a lot or all the time, it helps me understand what's in the book a good bit, was not written to Abraham or by Abraham or by Joseph near the end of the book. It was written by Moses 400 years later. And he was writing the letter, or the history, sorry, of Genesis for the Israelites. And they were getting ready to go out, across the Jordan and enter the promised land. And so sometime in that wandering period, Moses is preparing Israel to go into the land. Now think about why Abraham would be an important part of that story. First of all, it's their father. How did we get here as a race of people? But Abraham sojourned in the land, and certainly all the promises that Abraham was given related to the land and to that nation that had now just been formed 400 years later. So what I'd like to do in the third part of the lesson is to look at the lessons that Israel might have seen, because I think that's helpful to see how you apply a lesson to one man's life. Many parallels in Abraham's life. He went down to Egypt and came out with great substance, just as a simple example. There's a lot of things in his life that we can think of. The fact that he was leaving his home, or where he'd lived all this time, and traveling to a place God would show him, that certainly is an opening parallel to the life, or to the times of Israel and their wandering. So it helped explain the promises, his lineage, that is the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that Moses would refer to, the many places, Shechem, Beersheba, Bethel, Ai, all those are listed as part of Abraham's legacy, and his actually having lived there, the covenant of circumcision, the history and relationship with Egypt, such as it was. But there were other moral lessons that Abraham could learn and illustrated in Abraham's life, either by his foolishness or by his wisdom, either one. But the one was to be separate from the Canaanites. He separated himself early, and later when he got into Canaan, we'll see several instances in which he kept a distance from them. Let Lot go on down to Sodom, but he himself was careful in his transactions with those Canaanites that dwelt in the land. You can see obedience and punishment in the lessons of Abraham. Sodom and Gomorrah come out as one of the first ones you think of. Think of the Israelites thinking about when they got to see the Dead Sea for the first time and all that salt, to know that it used to look like the Garden of Eden until the immorality of the Sodom and Gomorrahites were such that God destroyed them. So that would be a lesson for them. But more than anything, I think, the lesson of Abraham would be to the Israelites that God provides. God provides, and you'll see that in the sacrifice of Isaac and the descriptions there. In the Bible, he's called the Father often, at least 18 times in the New Testament. He's the father of all that believe in Romans 4:11. He's believing Abraham, Galatians 3. But one of the most spectacular references is he's the friend of God. He's called that in James, and James calls him that because he's called that in the Old Testament a couple of times in 1 Chronicles and in Isaiah. What does it mean to be a friend of someone? One is that maybe it is you're loyal to them. And that could be that. Or maybe that you're a friend of someone because they are loyal to her, to him. I think that's more of it. When you're a friend of someone, you do anything you can for them. Or maybe there are some friends in which you can count on them to help you out when you're in trouble, right? Sometimes you have friends that are both of those, but sometimes you have friends that are only one. It may be that being the friend of God means someone that God befriended, that God protected, that God provided for, and God chose. And maybe that's the meaning of that. And it reminds me in James 4:4 that friendship with the world is enmity with God. So to be a friend of God, one has to be an enemy of the world. I'm going to show you a quick slide just to show you some of the major doctrines in the New Testament that come from the life of Abraham. And these are significant texts that take a while to understand even. One is that Abraham was justified by faith. That great verse in chapter 15 of Genesis, verse 6, that he was justified, he believed God, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. The point being, he was not yet circumcised. And Paul makes a big deal out of that. It wasn't his works. It wasn't his status as a religious, compliant person, but it was rather that he believed God at that point. Hebrews 11 goes to some great length to show that he believed in things that seemed impossible, how old he was to have children and other things, and that he believed in unseen promises, a possession, a city that has foundation, is some place that he could not see in the end. James 2 makes the point that faith is only alive when it works, like Abraham when he offered his son Isaac. Galatians makes the point that everybody is Abraham's seed if they're believers in Christ. That's his point, including Gentiles. Right, so don't get caught up in the race of the Abrahamic seed. It's rather all believers. And then, of course, in John 8, Jesus has that long discussion back and forth with the Jews in which he says, you're really not, you think you're the children of Abraham, but if you were, you'd look like him and you'd do the deeds of Abraham. But it's pretty clear your father is someone else, maybe the devil, based on the fact that you desire to kill me. So these are significant teachings that all come from the life of Abraham. Acts chapter 7, interesting, Stephen's sermon begins, really, I think, making mainly the point that Abraham had a promise to own the land, but he never got it. Interesting introduction to that. Remember, Stephen was on trial because he was denying the rights to be in the land, or he was trying to overthrow the temple and the land and that kind of thing. And he started by saying, no, it's supposed to be here. It was promised to Abraham, but he never owned it, so the fact that we have it is right. But let's talk about a review of Abraham's life. And I'm thankful to Russ for swapping with me. It gave me a little more time this afternoon to prepare, And also, this might take a while, but I hope not. I'm going to zoom through the chapters, just get a sense of these events. And I hope, I think especially true on a Sunday night, people are familiar with the events of Abraham's life. In chapter 11, the latter part, Terah, Abraham's father, and Lot, and there's some family connections, and his brother has died, they go to Haran. They leave Ur of the Chaldees, and that's in the Babylonian area. It's not Babylon, but it's in that area, and they go to Haran, which is way farther to the north and west. And then in chapter 12, the first three verses is where God appears to Abraham. And in that place, he makes the three promises. And that's really the unique place where the blessing to all the earth is listed. But you know what they are, right? There's the land and the nation and the blessing to all the earth. Those are the three promises made there. And he's commanded to leave Haran and go to a place that God would show him. And so he left Haran and was led to Canaan and ended up in Shechem to start with and then to Bethel Ai. And you understand those are names that were named later in the story. But just for the Jewish people reading the history, they would know where that was. And so these names came later, but they are the places where Abraham was. And he made an altar to Jehovah. That's so significant. You remember, God had a special name, Yahweh, and it was not used generally. People would think, believe in gods in some way, but that name is called by, or used by Abraham in his speech and by Sarah in her speech, where that's not really typically true of other characters before that. And so he built an altar to Jehovah, suggesting he had a personal relationship with Jehovah. Another interesting thing I'll just point out is that I just looked through the story of Noah again to see what kind of relationship Noah had with God. And maybe I missed it, but I didn't find anywhere where Noah said to God, "Well, but what about?" Or, "Could you repeat?" Noah never says anything to God, at least in the record. God says, "Do this," Noah does it. And that's pretty spectacular. But he never has a conversation. That's not true with Abraham. And so it's almost like we're getting back to the beginning when God would speak with Adam, for example, or with Cain when it was needed. And now here with Abraham, God is speaking with Noah and later with Moses face to face, a special relationship with a personal God. I won't go into the details about the adventures in Egypt. Do you remember what that was? It had to do with Sarah claiming she was his sister, not his wife, and but he does escape from Egypt and actually ends up a good bit wealthier. And he was really rescued by God from a kind of a knuckleheaded thing to do, as I think a way to say it, going down into Egypt. And that's covered in the first latter part of chapter 12. He returns to Bethel Ai and again calls, there it says he calls on the name of Jehovah. Again, the personal relationship with God. And then in chapter 13, Lot separates, and I'm curious sometimes to know why would God choose particular moments to recount or renew, review the promises to Abraham. And it may be that the loss of Lot, that separation, Lot moving down to Sodom and Gomorrah, the well-watered valley, fertile area of the Jordan, left Abraham to wonder, what's going on here? And he actually moves himself even farther away to Hebron, builds an altar there. But there, God renews the land and the nation promise, and he describes the people will be as the dust of the earth. That's how many people there will be. So, again, a promise made in chapter 13. You've noticed Abraham's age, I think, maybe the column over there. So we don't know how old he was. He's more than 75, but we're coming up on a place where we will know his age. Shortly after that, a king came from way off to the east, probably southern part of Iran, Elam it's called, and attacked the area of Canaan. And there was a big battle of four kings versus five kings. And Lot and a lot of the people of Sodom were taken captive. Abraham got his men together and rescued Lot and brought them back. And that's all recorded in chapter 14. And then on his way back, as he is coming back into the area with Lot, he runs into two kings. And this is kind of interesting. And the stories are actually interwoven. He comes up to the king of Sodom, but in the middle of that interaction, the king of Salem shows up, Melchizedek. And he has the interaction with Melchizedek. If you remember, he gives him a tithe of the spoils that he has gotten. But the king of Sodom comes back. He said, "You know, I'm so grateful." He didn't say that, but I'm sure that's what he was thinking. He says, "You keep all the stuff. Just get me the people." And Abram, at that point, says an interesting thing to him. He says, "You know, I've made a vow to the," I think he says, "the Almighty God," or something like that. He said, I don't want your stuff. I don't want anybody to think that you have made me rich. He gave him all the stuff back. Whereas with Melchizedek, he just gave him an offering and was blessed by Melchizedek. And I think those two kings, and the stories are interleaved if you look closely at it, is showing us a separation of Abraham where he is distancing himself from the Canaanites, from the kings of the Gentiles, if you want to, if we can even use that term that early. He just has no interest in having a relationship or a dependency or benefiting from them at all. Whereas with Melchizedek, it's clear he wants to have a relationship. And so he returns everything to the king of Sodom. After that, there is again a renewal of the promises. In chapter 15, here he learns that it's going to be from his own body. This Eliezer idea, another, by just a side point, by the way, I'm not sure Abraham's all that admirable from just his everyday wisdom. When God tells him to do something, he does it. And that's what we kind of admire. When he's left on his own, I'm not sure he's all that clever of a fellow. If you look at the decisions he made on his own. And that's me, by the way. That's me. I don't know that I know what I'm doing in life. But I hope it's the case when I know God wants me to do something that that's what I do. And I think that's a lesson to learn. Abraham's a man of like passions. And like foolishness with us, but he's thinking, okay, Eliezer, that's who it is. That's going to be my heir, even though it's not even his own son, really. God said, no, it's your own body. And he said, look at the stars. And he says, there's going to be a 400 years, and he gives him a lot of details of the history, which you see would be useful to the Israelites. That would explain why it had been so long and why they'd been in Egypt and all that. And then that verse in chapter 15, verse 6, when he was told that he would have a son, and now he's going to be 99 or 100, he believed it. And he believed God, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. And that verse is important. It's quoted in three different places, actually four times, but twice in one text, in the New Testament. And really, when it's quoted in the New Testament, it refers to various places in Abraham's life. One is referring to when he left his homeland. One is referring to when he believed he would have children in his old age. And one is referring, James, as you know, is referring to when he sacrificed Isaac. Now, when was he saved in the sense of, you know, believing in God and so on? When was he saved, if that's what it takes, is just faith is reckoned for righteousness? He was saved by his faithful life, expressed throughout his whole life, from the beginning to the end. In that verse, his faith saved him, reckoned for righteousness. Righteousness, you know, being justified. That's just a picture of his life. And the New Testament writers recognize that and refer to that verse to really represent the way he lived from the beginning to the end with regard to God. When he was 86, Ishmael was born. And you can kind of see what would have happened here. He knows that the seed is going to be from his own body, and Ishmael is. Not a great idea for Sarah to give him Hagar, another decision on his own that didn't work out very well. But he's thinking maybe this is it, because this is his own son. And as soon as she's pregnant, even before he's born, Sarah wants to run her out, but God intervenes, actually, and has Hagar come back to stay with Abraham. And I think he loved Ishmael. We're going to see that. He really believed Ishmael was maybe the promised son. Even when he wasn't, he wanted to protect him. And that comes up, I think, is important for later. And then chapter 17, then it's been 15 more years, 14 more years at least. Maybe God comes to him at this point because it's been a while and he's getting old. He's getting to be 99 years old. And at this point, he confirms the promises and changes his name and changes Sarah's name. And he becomes Abraham, or the father of multitudes. And he gives him a covenant of circumcision at that point. So he's 99. Not too many days later, I think, maybe weeks or months, but not more than a year, the birth of Isaac was promised. And that was done in an interesting way. These men were coming down to check on Sodom and Gomorrah to see if they're just as bad as it seemed like they were. And they were. And so Isaac's birth was promised. And you remember in the background, in the tent, what Sarah did. She laughed about that. She thought that's kind of funny. And I think her laughter was out of unbelief. And the reason I think that is because when they called her out, why are you laughing? She said, I didn't laugh. She denied that she laughed, suggesting that she felt a little guilty about it. Anyway, his birth was promised. And then another interesting adventure, like the one in Egypt, this time with Abimelech, down in the south in Gerar, but a similar situation where Sarah takes part in the lie, and once again God rescues him. Isaac is born about a year later, and Ishmael is driven out. And in the customs of that day, if you had a child by a concubine or some other than your wife, it really was a disgrace to drive that child out and not make it part of your care and part of your family. I think that should be true today. If you have an illegitimate child, it ought to be a shameful thing not to take care of it. And it was then too. But the interesting thing is God said to him, no, in this case, do what Sarah wants to do. Because remember, Ishmael was ridiculing Isaac. He was probably 13 years old or so. That's a little bit of a shocking thing. You ought to think about that. And that is, Ishmael, whom I believe Abraham loved, he was told to let him go. But don't worry, I'll take care of him, God said. I'll make him a great nation too. And he did that. He did that. But an interesting request that was given of Ishmael, which if you think about it, is a little bit of a foreshadowing of something to come. That is to drive Ishmael out, the son whom he loved. And then he had a bargain time with Beersheba, suggesting to me that he just had difficulty in the land. When you don't own the land, when you're a sojourner and you live in tents and you need a place to bury people, or you dig a well and somebody else thinks they own the property, it's hard. And you're going to have controversy. And that's kind of what happened there with Abimelech, again, the same guy. And then reaching near the top of the mountain of faith is that God commands the sacrifice of Isaac. We can say more about the story later. I don't know how much detail to go into now. We can talk about it then, I guess. But he just says, do it. Not much explanation. He gives him overnight. I don't think he needed to think about it much. But then they did that. It was a 3 days journey. And you remember that story, and Andrew reminded us of the emotional impact of that just last Sunday. In chapter 23, a good while later, he was 137 years old, Sarah 127. She dies and is buried in a cave. He didn't have any land. In fact, Stephen says he didn't even have a place to put his foot, I believe is the way Stephen records it in chapter 7 of Acts. But he said that he needed a place to bury Sarah, so the text in Genesis says that he made a deal with, I forget the fellow's name, the cave of Machpelah there in Hebron, and of course that's the eventual place that he would die. And then I'm skipping over 24, which is that very long chapter which repeats the story of how Isaac's wife was going to be found, and it happens that way. But then Abraham dies at 175 years old. Interesting to know that Isaac and Ishmael were there standing side by side at the burial place in Beersheba as Abraham was buried. There are a couple more details about Abraham's life that come from other writers. And I don't know that it's necessarily new information. All of it maybe could be derived from the details in the book of Genesis. But I'm going to suggest four other facts that might be important. When Joshua was recounting the story of Abraham near the end of his life to the Israelites, again, same group, he said this, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in the old times, and they served other gods." Does that strike you as funny? That Terah, the father of Abraham, and his family were idolaters? That seems significant to me, given the way the story begins with God just saying to go out of that land. That's an interesting detail. We might have been able to figure that out, but Joshua tells us that. In the book of Acts, Stephen, again, I think also by inspiration, says this, "Brethren and fathers, listen, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran." Now, that's a detail that's not exactly described in Genesis. So what it actually says is that the departure from Mesopotamia, or the Chaldees, to go to Haran was something God initiated as well. So he moved him once, and then he moved him again. And he had him leave that very civilized, peak, you know, of power kind of an empire in the Ur of the Chaldees, and that was part of God's plan for him too. These are not great details, it's just additional information, I think, that you would not necessarily know for sure from the Genesis account. This one is fascinating to me, and it's important for something we'll talk about later. In Romans 4, Paul says that Abraham, not being weak in faith, did not consider his own body, now 99 years old, already dead since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. So you see, that had to do with the prophecy that identified Sarah, and that would be chapter 18. And he did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God, being fully convinced that what he had promised, he was able to perform. Therefore, it was accounted to him for righteousness. I'm telling you that Sarah laughed out of unbelief. Abraham didn't not believe. Sorry, Abraham believed. Thank you. That wasn't a problem with him. He took it, and he, in fact, we'll look at that text a little bit later, but I just want you to know that Abraham believed it when God said, just like everything else appears that he believed. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son. That's a familiar phrase, isn't it? Only begotten son. We'll see there's another similarity too. Of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, concluding, Abraham did, that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. That's not exactly in Genesis, but it's interesting that he tells the men, after he sets off, he leaves them behind, and he sets off with Isaac carrying the wood. He says, you stay here, we're going to go up and do the sacrifice, and then we'll come back. So I don't know if he thought, I don't know what he thought. I guess maybe he thought God could raise him from the dead, which in a way, he kind of did. So those are four kind of details. There probably are others. I thought about a few others that we could have added that help me understand various incidents in the story, but they come from other parts of the Bible. So what do we learn? What are the lessons for Israel first? And then maybe what are the lessons for us? I think the first one is that we're on a journey and we're going to a place that God's going to show us. Are we willing to leave our... Well, I should say, I'm going to try to do it this way. The Israelites had to leave Egypt, where they maybe had made a living. It wasn't much of one, and it became a better living in their memory than it actually was. But still, they had to leave that country behind, what they knew, to a place that they didn't know, they had not been to, that they were going to have to count on God to show them. Do you see your Christian life in that way? Do I see mine that way? Or do we want everything spelled out and secure, and we know exactly what's going to happen and how hard or how easy it's going to be? Or are we willing just to step out and do it and let God figure out where we're going to go in the end? I think that's what the Israelites needed to do, and that's what we need to do with a kind of a confidence. God said, it's a place I will show you, Genesis 12, verse 2. Hebrews 11, verse 8 added that they didn't know where they were going. It's interesting, Abraham's family. The other thing that Hebrews tells us in chapter 11 is, and if they had been mindful of the place they came from, they could have gone back. And you know, the Israelites always kept saying, I wish we stayed in Egypt. That was their thing all through the wanderings. Do we ever have that same fear that we're in a place where we just need to go back to where we were? This is harder than I thought it was going to be. I'm insecure. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what's going to happen. God's making me do things that are hard, and they're giving me great uncertainty in my life. I want to go back. And as you know, the book of Hebrews is about not shrinking back out of fear. So they could have returned. So I think the first lesson for us to know is that we are on a journey. Emphasis on the word journey. And that is, it will be a different place tomorrow than it is today. Abraham moved from Mesopotamia to Haran, then to Canaan, and he kept on moving around in various places in Canaan. He had to, because he was a sojourner. He had no place of his own. And that leads us to the second point. And that is, we are different from everyone around us. You can see that in the case of Abraham. First of all, he was different, I think, in his home country. He was a believer in the God, and the God, the I Am God, the Jehovah God, the personal God. He was just different. In fact, when you think about Abraham's theology, I've collected a few facts about that based on things that he said. He himself actually said. The term Jehovah means the self-existent, I Am present God. And of course, you know the story that same name was explained to Moses when he asked who he was supposed to say sent him back to the Israelites. He was a personal God. I mentioned before that he didn't just give Abraham commands. Abraham talked to him and asked questions and made stupid proposals that God had to straighten him out on. But he had a personal relationship, because it was a personal God who told him things to do and kept his promises. He calls him the possessor of heaven and earth in chapter 14, and also in chapter 24 when he sends the servant out to find the wife for Isaac, which suggests he knew who the Creator was. Abraham knew that. He knew God was able. Romans 4:24, we just read that verse about. He knew God was able to make children out of old people. He didn't doubt that God could do that. And he knew that he was a righteous judge. Interesting, the interaction where Abraham appeals for the 50, 45, 40, 30, 20 in Sodom. You remember that story, the bargaining thing? And he kind of says, I know you're a just God. And suggesting that both the salvation of the righteous as well as the punishment of the wicked was what he expected of this God that he believed in. He knew that he was superior. He called him Jehovah Most High when he made that declaration of the king of Sodom that said, I don't want your stuff. You know, I've made a vow to the God Most High, the superior God, the supreme God, Most High of all gods. And that he's eternal. He called on Jehovah, the everlasting God, and that's a phrase he used with Abimelech during the covenant making over the wells in chapter 21. Abraham believed in a different God, and so the Israelites had to. They were going to be among the gods of the Canaanites that had all kinds of imperfections and limitations. They were limited in space. Their jurisdiction, you know, was only in the valleys but not in the mountains or various regions of the earth. Jehovah was not bound by that, right? They were imperfect. They were limited. They couldn't do anything. Elijah demonstrated that, how powerless and impotent they were. And the prophets just made fun of them and their inability to speak or move their hands or anything. On the other hand, Jehovah is powerful. I think we have to understand that our perception of God as an infinite personal God who speaks directly in propositional terms and commands us things and tells us the future, which will come to pass, is different from the world around us' view of God. It just is. And more different every day. And we are going to be different when we speak of God that way and live in such a way that we respect His commands as the Most High, the possessor of heavens and earth, as a personal God who speaks to us. And I don't know that we do that. We're just in a culture that remakes God in whatever image is convenient to satisfy our own lusts, according to the message of 2 Peter chapter 2. So, we're different from all around us. And it's interesting that when he was purchasing that cave from, somebody help me remember the guy's name because I can't, but the cave of Machpelah, Ephraim, is that it? Who did you say it? Ephraim, thank you. Yeah, see, you already know all this stuff. He said, I'm just a sojourner here, and that's why I don't have a place to bury anybody. He just confessed that here near the end of his life, he really had never actually owned anything. And we heard from Stephen that he didn't have a place to put his foot. We saw that he honored Melchizedek differently from the king of Sodom. And he sought a wife for Isaac right at the end of his life. You remember he said, please, just swear to me that he will not marry someone from this area. It was such a separation, such a different man living. And he didn't really care to be in any of the cities. He dwelt in tents, you remember that? And he moved around. I wonder if we can live that way. Separate from the world. Not even owning anything, because it doesn't matter. We're looking for something more permanent. And that's the way Abraham lived, and that's the way we need to live as his children by faith. A third thing that we need to learn, and Israel needed to learn, was that God tests our faith with surprises and with difficult commands. I had 2 points out of this. I smashed them into one. I don't think it'll make the lesson any shorter. But isn't that true that God tests us by giving us things that just... I don't get that. It doesn't seem right. And it doesn't make it... It's not going to be easier. It's not going to be spiritually beneficial. These are things that I'm thinking about in my own life. I mean, why are you doing this? Why are you waiting till I'm 99 to get started with this child thing? I mean, among other things, right? In Abraham's life. And I'm sure the Israelites were thinking, now let's see. We've run away from the Egyptians. They're coming at us with their chariots, and the Red Sea is in our way. This doesn't seem like a clever plan to me. And yet God chose that path. Why does He choose those paths? And it's pretty clear He's doing it. I think maybe 2 reasons, and maybe they're the same. One is to test our faith. Do we really believe that what He said for us to do, our commitment in our life to our morality and to our families and to obedience to His simple commands, which seem so old-fashioned in our worship and other things, He's testing us in the case of the world. But I also think it's the case, too, that when you do something that seems a little bit stupid, irrational, unsuccessful, and it works, do you see that God gets glory for that? And I think that's the thing with Abraham. Just wait, it's going to happen like I said. And then all these other things make it look like it's not. And when it does, you have to say, well, that's just grace. That's God's grace doing that. It isn't me. I'd have never thought of that. Nothing I was doing worked out. And so in the same way the Israelites, when they depended on God not to have armies, not to have horses, just to wait, and when they needed a deliverer, God provided one, and they survived that way. Can we live that way? Dealing with life surprises that just don't make any sense to us, but really maybe God has a plan, and if we just do what He says, even if it's difficult and maybe doesn't make the most sense. I think about the way that Abraham's faith in these promises was tested. Let me read some of these to you. The land promise. Think about the land promise. Abraham, it's all yours. I want you to walk from one end to the other. It's all yours. Right? Every place you sit, your foot. The land was inhabited by Canaanites and others. In fact, it's interesting that at the end, I believe it's chapter 15 or 14, God says, this is your land. It's the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites, and he describes the land based on who all's in it at the moment, which is a little bit strange. It was already occupied. He was a migrant. He lived in a tent the whole time. The first thing that happened when he got there is there was a famine, and he had to leave. Had to go to Egypt. There wasn't enough room for him and Lot to live together. He was invaded by foreigners. That doesn't seem like a good plan, if this is my land. There were disputes with Abimelech over the wells, as we saw. He was forced to buy his own burial ground. And as Stephen says, he died without even a place to set his foot. And what about the seed promise? What were some tests there? Well, Sarah was barren during the years where she might have had a child. The alternate plans that he proposed with Eliezer, and thinking Ishmael perhaps, God rejected those plans. Those seemed to be more sensible. And then he was made to wait 25 years after the first promise for that son to finally be born. But I think in looking at these tests, another thing we should say about these tests which surprise us and they're difficult for us is, I think God helps us in this way, and I think He helped Abraham in this way. Do you see a kind of progression in these tests? The first thing he was asked to do was not to sacrifice his only beloved son. That wasn't the first thing. That was kind of the last thing. It was a culmination in a sense. And just before that, He kind of was told by God, no, let Ishmael go. I will take care of him. Don't worry about that. And then before that, a few of it, leave the land behind that you're part of. So it seemed like, and then in addition to that, all these times that Abraham would get in trouble, have to go rescue Lot, he was successful. Clearly God was watching over him. And each of those events, I think, built his faith up. And if we're on a journey, it seems to me we need to be traveling a little bit higher each time, so that when we're asked to finally reach what Abraham reached at Mount Moriah, we have this history of faith-confirming events in our lives and strength in the decisions that we've made and proven to ourselves that we are able to do it and that God does provide when we're asked to do that. So it was a progressive testing, I think, that Abraham went through. And the Israelites would have the same situation as they moved into conquering the land. And that leads us to really getting close to the story of Isaac and the sacrifice of Isaac. I don't know really what to make. There's a lot of things that could be said. I think one thing that has to be said is that whatever Abraham was asked by God to do, God was willing to do himself with his own son. And the chapter 21 begins by saying, you take your son Isaac, whom you love. Apparently in the Greek translation of that Hebrew text, it reads pretty clearly like your son, your beloved son in whom you love, in whom you're well pleased. It's just very close to a lot of New Testament references to the way God and Jesus are referring to, or God refers to Jesus. His only begotten son, whom I love, this is my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased, and those kind of things. So I think we should say that God doesn't ask, but Abraham didn't know that. That's kind of in the future. He didn't know that would be the case. But I think in the end, everything Abraham had was a gift from God. And maybe there was something about Isaac being a product of his own body. And God just finally says, you know, this is the last test. And that is, the thing that's the most important to you, you have to be able to give it up. And that's where he ended up, I think, as the final test, to say, this is maybe the proof that you've gone all the way, to where nothing that you have would be withholden from God if He asked you for it. Maybe that's the significance of that. And I think about how many, I'm skipping over Israel for now, how many things in our lives, as David Maxon used to say, rooms that we don't let God into. Remember him saying that? This is a secret room, a private room. That's not for religion to enter. And we hold that out as a separate compartment of our life and do not bring it in subjection to God. The rich man being told to sell all that he had comes to mind with regard to that. And then the last lesson, I think, for us, and really for Abraham and the Israelites as well, is there's a bigger story. We think of our lives as real important, and somehow by the time we get to the end, we have to accomplish something great, or God has to have accomplished something great in us. Think about those promises that Abraham got. A nation, a land, and the blessing to all the earth. Which of those did he see the fulfillment of in his life? Really? Really none. I mean, he did finally have a son. I think he lived long enough to see his two grandsons, right? I believe that's right, if you do the math. Still, and he did have other sons with a different wife. Still, that was a long way off. And there was some kind of a bigger story. The Hebrew writer says this, in the middle of the discussion of Abraham. Abraham's discussed here, and he's discussed here, and in the middle of that, he says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were assured of them, embracing them, is what the Hebrew writer says about Abraham's attitude toward that. I think in our lives we have to be thinking that we're just not the center of the universe, and that our little life is part of a large plan that God has that's way more significant, and probably not too easy for us to understand in our limitations. I don't mean to say that God doesn't love us, and for each of us He has a purpose and a blessing and a destiny that's more than we ever deserve. I'm not saying that. I am saying that there is a greater plan at work that we only see glimpses of. And it could be that Abraham saw a glimpse of that. It's interesting in Genesis chapter 22, there is almost like a reference to the fact that this was written for somebody else, the Israelites maybe in particular. It describes the fact that that place where Abraham sacrificed Isaac got a name. It was called Jehovah Provides, or Jehovah Nissi, if I can find it. So Abraham went, he took the ram that was caught in the thicket, offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. Literally, it means the Lord sees. I think the idea is we use the phrase see to it, or he is able to see what we need and provide it. As it is said to this day, the writer Moses of Genesis says, to this day. So there's a sense in which what Abraham did and experienced in God providing a substitute sacrifice lives on to the very day that Genesis was written. And here's the quote, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. There's a sense in which maybe I think Abraham got a glimpse of the way God was going to work in the future. And that is that he would provide for people. People who believed in him deeply enough to give up everything in their life, but then God would provide the sacrifice for them. I think Abraham could see that, and that story then could live on as a bigger story. I don't know if you saw the outline or not, but I said I was going to have a funny story at the end. That was to try to keep you awake and just say stay the end. And that's not exactly true, but I am going to have a story that is about laughing to conclude the lesson. It kind of relates to this point about the bigger story and the sacrifice of Isaac. You remember that when those men came, before that, when Abraham was first told in chapter 17 that, no, it's not Ishmael, it's going to be Sarah who's the mother. He knew it was him, the father, right? It would be your body. But in chapter 17, after some period of waiting, God says, you know what, it's going to be Sarah. And this is what the text says. Abraham fell on his face and laughed. And he said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old, and shall Sarah, who is 99 years old, bear a child? That's how old he was at that point. Now, I showed you that text in Romans, so you won't think that Abraham was saying that out of unbelief. You get that? The text in Romans says he believed God and it was reckoned to him for... And he says, he said, in fact, it says he was hoping beyond hope or something like that. Abraham believed that. Why was he laughing? I don't know exactly. It isn't because he didn't believe. I think he was just slapping his knee and saying, "No kidding." I think that's it. That's the only way I can explain it. Romans says he believed it. And God doesn't condemn him for that. He just says, "No, that can't, really." Out of belief, out of joy, I think, this is going to happen. God's promising, I know it's going to happen. And you've probably seen that in people that never had kids till they were old, and all of a sudden, and everybody's just shocked, and everybody's happy, and you're just, almost you just want to laugh. It's just, it's kind of funny. And I think that's the way Abraham thought about it. But Sarah's laughing was not that way. And so in the next chapter, when Sarah is in her tent, and the men come on their way to Sodom and Gomorrah and say, "You're about this time next year, you're going to have a baby. Sarah's going to have a baby, in fact." And Sarah laughed within herself. She says, "How, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And I won't read the rest of the text, but you know, God, it's not clear whether that was actually God, an angel of the God of Jehovah or what, but he says, "Why'd you laugh?" And she said, "No, I didn't laugh." Clearly she felt guilty, and it was out of unbelief, I think, that she laughed in that occasion. There's another time that Sarah laughed, and there's a little bit of, a chiasm here, maybe. But then, when Isaac was finally born in chapter 21, and she does have a baby at 99 years old, and he's the son of promise, besides all that, and she names him, I wrote it down so I could pronounce it, so that I could pretend to pronounce it. The word for laugh in Hebrew is tsokak, which is almost like an onomatopoeia. It sounds like you're laughing. And Yitzchak is the name of their son, Isaac. And so she names Isaac the one who laughs. Why did she name him that? Because laughter was bound up both in his promise and in her unbelief and then finally in his birth. And she goes on to say everybody else is going to laugh when they hear this too. Not laughing in unbelief, but laughing out of joy. There's one other kind of laughter, and I'm stretching just a little, I admit this. But Jesus is arguing again now, fast forward 2,000 years to Jesus confronting the Jews who claim to be the children of Abraham. And he says, "No, you're not. You're the children of the devil." And he just mentioned that before Abraham was, I am, the Jehovah word, the God that Abraham believed in, actually. And later in the text, right near the end, he brings Abraham back up again. And I'll just show you this text is interesting. And it seems to me that when Abraham was there and he was about to sacrifice Isaac, the son of promise, at the end of this long life of promise and fulfillment, of faith in God, of protection, of rescue from his own foolishness, and there in simple obedience, God says, "No, here's a substitute for that." And that place became known. And by the way, it was at Mount Moriah. The only other time Moriah is used is in 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1. It's the location of the temple, or some near where the temple was. There is Abraham seeing that God does provide. And Jesus says this about that. "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see by day." In the Greek, that word rejoice means, jump again, or much jumping or leaping. It's kind of what it's got an intensifier on the front. Leaping for joy is the idea. Abraham leaped for joy, and he saw it and was glad, which means full of cheer. That's the way that Greek word means. It's interesting. I don't know if this means that somehow after Abraham died, he looked back and he saw the events of Jesus' life. I really don't think that's right. I think that in that sacrifice of Isaac, he saw revealed to him in a way God's plan for all man in the sacrificial death of Jesus, and he laughed at that again. Now, he may not have been laughing for the three days journey to take Isaac up there to kill him, but when he saw God's plan, there's just he's happy again. I get it. This is the way God does everything. I wish we could see our life as ending in laughter. Because we struggle through things we don't understand, and we try to obey God when it's difficult. We leave our family behind. We're different from the whole world around us. We're strangers and sojourners, and we need to confess that. But we're going to laugh in the end, we're going to laugh just like Abraham did. And we will rejoice to see the day and be glad. Just like when Abraham slapped his knee and said, "No kidding. No kidding. That's the way you're going to do it." And that's the way the children of Abraham live. In joy, looking for joy. Looking for a city that has foundations is the way the Hebrew writer says it. And we're looking for that in our lives as well. Well, I want you all to be children of Abraham. And if, according to Galatians, if you're in Christ, you are children of faithful Abraham. And you get into Christ by taking advantage of his substitute death, just like God provided a substitute for Isaac. And that he has sacrificed himself as the beloved Son of God, just like Isaac was of Abraham. And that substitutionary death is available to us to be in a right relationship with God, to let him be our friend, to do the favors and provide the blessings for us, which include a forgiveness of sins and thus hope of the city that has foundations in the life to come. If you need to do something in a public way, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing. When thou didst come to this poor world,